A majority of Florida voters now support a wide range of so-called smart justice reforms. That's according to a new poll by a consortium of conservative think tanks and policymakers. Is the conservative argument for criminal justice reform what will finally bring about change? We'll discuss. Good morning, and live from Studio 5, this is First Coast Connect on 89.9. Thanks for listening. I'm Ryan Bank, in for Melissa Ross. We're always live here at 9, and make sure to subscribe to our podcast on iTunes or through the WJCT app. And just ahead, former Florida Senate President and supporter of smart justice reforms, Mike Haradopoulos, joins us to talk about the new poll and the conservative case for criminal justice reform. Later, we get into the holiday spirit with a preview of the annual San Marco holiday program this Sunday, plus cybersecurity this Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, and Cyber Monday. Give us a call at 549-2937. All of that and more ahead. But first this hour, Right on Crime is a national campaign to promote what the group calls a successful and conservative solution to some of the problems plaguing the American criminal justice system. The group, in partnership with a number of Florida conservative think tanks like the Reason Foundation and the James Madison Institute, conducted a poll that adds to data suggesting a sea change in residents' views on criminal justice reform. The poll, conducted by Fabrizio Lee and Associates, was commissioned by Right on Crime and surveyed 800 registered voters statewide, plus an oversample of 600 registered Republicans. It found that roughly 3 in 4 registered voters support ending the practice of suspending driver's licenses for failure to pay court fees or fines if the person is indigent. That proportion doesn't change when looking at just Republican voters. 3/4 of both voting bases support the creation of more county civil citation programs. And perhaps most stunningly, 2/3 or more of both groups also support giving judges more leeway in mandatory minimum cases for 3- and 5-year sentences for first-time drug offenders. Joining us to talk more about the poll and the conservative case for reform is the former Florida Senate President, Mike Haradopoulos. Thanks for being here.
My pleasure. Thanks for the opportunity.
So for those who may be unfamiliar with your tenure in the legislature, you were the Senate president between 2010 and 2012. And while you were there and also in the Florida House, you were instrumental in some diversion programs. In our area in 2016, we saw a kind of massive redirection of criminal justice policy in the form of ousting a tough-on-crime prosecutor by the name of Angela Corey and replacing her with a more reform-minded Republican Melissa Nelson. You know, it kind of seems like around the state and around the country, we're turning a corner here. Do you feel that way?
I do. I think that people want to look at the big picture. I think without doubt, the poll shows that we want to think outside the box, find real solutions as opposed to just throwing the book at anybody and everybody. I think where we draw the line, not only as conservatives, but as humanitarians, is a simple idea that when a person commits a violent crime against a fellow American, there's going to be a harsh penalty. I don't think there's any doubt about that. We're talking about rape, murder, other violent crimes. But when we're talking about these property-type crimes, that's where we want to be a little bit more thoughtful. Make sure that if this is a first-time offender, let's try to find that right program so that they do not commit this crime again. And I think that's where this Right on Crime policy and idea is gaining momentum. We're trying to make it where we don't punish everybody. We're smart and selective in how we do it. And if it's a violent crime, sure, we're going to be absolutely tough on crime. But on these property crimes we're talking about today, we need to find ways that first ask the question, why did this happen? Can we prevent it from happening again? So we simply just don't put a person into a criminal justice system. And when they come out, they might not be productive in society or might commit more crimes.
And the number to call if you have a question for former Senate President Mike Haradopoulos or you have a comment on smart justice reform, criminal justice reform at large, or the conservative case for change, please give us a call at 549-2937. Again, the number is 549-2937. We're already getting some tweets regarding this subject. What was it, I mean, or what have you seen since you left the legislature that you can really point to as kind of a moment, either a singular moment or a sequence of events that kind of led to this turning of the corner? We have to be honest here, even though there were other voices in the room that agreed with a more kind of punitive form of criminal justice, the loudest voices for that over the years have been Republicans. So what's changed?
That's a good question, and I think it's an excellent point. The great news in Florida right now is we're enjoying the lowest crime rate literally in our modern history, the last 40-odd years. And it has a lot to do with going against those violent criminals, meaning we invoked the 3 strikes and you're out. We've kept the penalty in place. We have really made it where our public safety officers are in a good position to be well-informed and doing a great job of going after those, let's just say, violent offenders and repeat offenders, people who have preyed on others. But we're also trying to look outside the box and say, you know, well, there are the smaller crimes. These are the small drug crimes. These are some of the small property crimes. And saying, do we want to really put these people into the criminal justice system, which might make them career criminals? Or could we, early, if they commit a smaller property crime against another Floridian, can we create a solution where there's a real solution so these people are productive members of society and they don't further fall into the, let's just say, the life of crime? And that's the area we're trying to look at. Again, we strongly believe in penalizing folks who do the violent offenses, but let's draw the line on the smaller property crimes, the smaller drug crimes, especially when Floridians voted over 70% of the case to at least legalize medical marijuana. We're seeing a change in philosophy, and we're trying to react to that without undercutting our success in reducing crime across our state. It's not an easy endeavor, but we're trying to do the right thing so we don't simply lock people up, throw away the keys, who could be saved. And then there's a difference between being mad at a person for doing something bad and on a property crime versus a person-to-person violent offense. And that's where I drew the line in my philosophy. I was very tough on crime in my career. I really wanted to make sure those violent offenders were locked up for a long period of time because of what they've done to other Floridians. But I've also recognized that there are some areas where we can make true reforms, and the statistics don't lie. In other states that tried some of these outside-the-box reforms, we found real success, and that's really the things that all legislators need to be conscious of. When they're willing to take the time to explain the difference between right on crime and our previous policies, people are in support, and that's what we're attempting to do with this policy measure.
Sure. And again, that number is 549-2937. We're getting a couple of calls, and we're going to get to them as soon as possible. But I wanted to address that point because another thing that this poll found was that a majority of Florida voters believe that the whole point of the criminal justice system is to rehabilitate people and not to punish them. That in itself is a total change in philosophy for the public, isn't it? I mean, we've gone through the crime wave in the 1990s and the tough on crime rhetoric when most people thought, you know, what you needed to do was to ensure that there was some type of massive diversion of this crime using punitive measures, that hopefully that people would see, hey, if I go away this long to prison or if I get this type of punishment, then it's not worth it. But we're seeing a change in that philosophy in the public.
Well, I completely agree with you, and I think we're that is a philosophy that we're all in agreement with. When asked the more specific question of what type of crimes we really want to punish them or put them away for a longer period of time, they would invariably say violent crime. Whereas what we're trying to focus on here in Florida in their legislative agenda is the idea of these property crimes, the smaller type of crimes or the smaller drug crimes, which weren't these violent offenses. But I agree with you. And the second part of this point is whether whatever crime they commit, they are going to get out of prison at some point. Most of these crimes are not death sentences, let alone life sentences. And so when they're in prison, we need to figure out a system that works so that when they do come back on our streets and back into our communities, they're not an additional threat. And that's going to take a lot of effort, and it's a difficult one because we have so many broken families across our state, and a lot of these people come from broken families or drug addiction. So we need to have these solutions inside their criminal justice system so that when they do get out, they're not an even bigger threat. And that's, again, a challenge for our state, but I think we're up to that challenge where we say to those most violent offenders, you're going to be there in there for life for rape and murder and so forth.
Sure.
But for those folks who are going to get out, we need to be prepared because the last thing we want is a whole wave of people coming out of prison angry and want revenge, so to speak.
Sure. Well, we've got a call now. We're going to go to Roger on the South Side. Roger, you are on the air. What is your question? Roger? You there, Roger? Hey, Roger, you're on the air. Sorry about that.
I am. Good morning.
Good morning. What's your question?
Well, my comment is I would like to the public to be more aware of the costs of the criminal justice system. So when we hear that somebody has been sentenced, say, 3 years for some petty crime, how much has been spent so far, and how much is an incarceration going to cost?
Sure. Thank
and
you.
And I wouldn't be a bit surprised if we end up with a figure like $200,000.
Thank you.
Which could be so much better spent.
Well, I can tell you, U.S.-wide, countrywide, we are looking at, according to a PBS study on this, we are looking at $250 billion a year on incarceration. That includes all types, I believe, from state penitentiaries to federal prison. That's actually, you know, one of the arguments that that moves some fiscal conservatives, aside from the moral argument about whether or not we're supposed to rehabilitate people or punish them, isn't that the case, Mr. Senate President?
Yes, it is. It's exactly the case. Good question, Roger. And these are, again, you have to ask the cost-benefit analysis. When you put some of these criminals away who committed these more petty crimes, you're still talking about in Florida between $30,000 and $35,000 per inmate per year. And so if a person, as Roger mentioned, gets a three-year sentence, you're looking at well north of $100,000 to keep that person incarcerated for what might have been a $500 property crime. And so these are the kind of cost-benefit analysis we have to look at. Can we put them in that, not only a diversion program, but doing community service, doing other things to add to society as opposed to subtracting from society? And then when you put a person in that type of route, it's a much less expensive alternative so that we have more money for other programs, whether it be healthcare or education, or using some of that savings for some of the counseling and other changes that need to be made in the prison system. So when some of these people do get out of prison, that they can actually function in society and not be a further risk to society. So that's how we're trying to look at this cost-benefit analysis. Again, these nonviolent offenders, these people who have committed minor crimes, how can we get them to where they're not spending hundreds of thousands of dollars of taxpayer money and taking from the system, but be in addition to the system, or at least making sure that it's a balanced effort? And these are real dollars. And as we all know, when approximately 35 to 40% of every dollar you earn goes to paying taxes in one form or another, whenever we can reduce these costs, we're a better society. And also, if we can reduce and put in more effective means, we're a better society. So we're trying to find that balance. And I don't pretend it's easy. The last thing I want to see is a violent offender get out of prison. But I also want to recognize that some of these facts are reality, and we need to be prepared for them when they do come back into society.
And, of course, we have the problem of recidivism. So if these people end up going back to prison, that's an even greater cost if they're not rehabilitated properly the first time. Our number, again, is 549-2937. Please give us a call with your thoughts on criminal justice reform and this poll from Right on Crime that we're speaking about. We've got former Senate President for Florida, Mike Haridopoulos, on the line talking about this with us. A question that I had was, so there's an actual piece of legislation out there right now sponsored by a Republican and a Democrat in Florida that Right on Crime is very supportive of, and so are these other think tanks that were involved with this poll. And essentially, as I said from the top of the hour, what it would do is give judges a little bit more leeway when it comes to specific mandatory minimum cases. So it would have to be a first-time drug offense, and it would have to be a mandatory minimum of 3 to 5 years. And people, you know, believe that in this poll and also through this bill that judges should have leeway to be able to kind of cancel out or curtail some of that time. Can you explain a little bit more about that specific measure and about that specific idea, giving judges more leeway in mandatory minimum cases?
Absolutely. I think where the whole premise of the mandatory minimums came in effect was, as you mentioned earlier in our broadcast, when we had a huge crime wave in the 1970s, 80s, and 90s here in Florida, and we were trying to figure out a way to curb that crime wave. And what we were reading about is that a person who was convicted of murder would get only, you know, 5 or 6 years because of either lenient sentencing or early parole. And Floridians were outraged by such things, and rightfully so. And so what did we do? We reacted smartly and said there's going to be a minimum sentence without discretion from the judge on certain offenses where they must serve a certain period of their sentence. We have a thing called The 85% rule, that means if you commit a crime, you must serve 85% of your sentence, because prior to that, it was simply not happening. And that has been a really effective tool, especially against violent crime mandatory minimums. But as you mentioned, this latest legislation that we're working on together is that we're looking at specifically and the smaller crimes, and as you put, most importantly, first-time offenders. These are people who are, quote, new to the criminal justice system. They've not committed a violent act of the highest degree against another Floridian, and we need to give the judge some discretion, or if they see there's an opportunity for this person to reform themselves or do community service, get into different types of programs, that hopefully this is a one-time act, as opposed to putting them into prison for 3 to 5 years for a low offense or a low economic crime, that they don't come out as hardened criminals because they've interacted with some of the hardened criminals in our criminal justice system. And so that's the balance we're trying to strike. Make sure we don't go back to the old days where it's just a revolving door and these career criminals are committing mayhem in Florida versus first-time offenders, and trying to give the judge some discretion to find a solution to a problem that doesn't cost us not only in the pocketbook, but more importantly, where they're not committing further crimes against fellow Floridians.
Give us a call at 549-2937. Make your voice heard about criminal justice reform, and specifically the conservative case to do that. Now, I guess the uncomfortable thing that a lot of us have to admit, and that I think most people looking at the data will see, is, as I mentioned, it's $250 billion a year the U.S. spends. We have the highest rate of incarceration in the world. And as much as these measures can seem like a very good step in reforming, dealing with first-time drug offenders and specifically giving judges more leeway for those cases, aren't there vastly more cases where there may be an act of violence, or maybe it's not the first time, maybe it's the second or third time that somebody is caught with possession of marijuana or with another drug? If we really want to make a dent in our incarceration rate here and bring down the cost of incarceration, don't we have to go after those most difficult cases as well?
I agree. Those are challenges for all of us, and that's where the diversion programs and counseling programs come in. I mean, I'm a believer in some of those programs when they are put into effect. And this isn't just show up here once or twice. These are intense counseling sessions. These are getting people off the drug. I mean, as you know, right here in the state of Florida, we had a pill mill crisis and issues with like fentanyl, where these people have become quickly addicted to these powerful narcotics. And they've become so desperate for the resources to get this drug back into their system that they're willing to commit an act of crime. And we need to aggressively go after this, or we're going to have a generation of people who are going to be coming in and out of the criminal justice system. And so when they make that mistake with a small drug crime or minor property crime, we need to intervene. It's much like we've done with our education system. We said that if a student doesn't pass their third grade test, that we're going to intensively handle that concern, and we're going to make it so they're not constantly just being kind of pushed through the system. We need to address the problem, whether it be reading or writing or arithmetic. In that third grade, we're going to address it. We're going to heavily work with that individual, and we're going to make it where they're ready to move on to the next part of their life. That's what we're trying to do here, is that we're trying to create that situation. We don't have that second and third and fourth offense, because once you run into that number, it's really hard to defend that criminal act, and you start asking the question, can this person really be turned around? But if they're that first-time offender, or if it's small property crime, let's try to create a true solution using other solutions from other states that have worked, and make it work here in Florida, as we're enjoying this better time in Florida, meaning our economy is stronger, and we also know that our crime rate is lower. We can take that extra time and try to save individuals, as opposed to simply lock them up for 3 to 5 years for a minor offense and so wonder what's going to happen when they come out.
Right. The point that you're trying to make then is, you know, yes, we have these difficult cases that we do have to address that are already in the system, but by implementing something like this, you can kind of nip a life of crime in the bud, so to speak, before it actually blossoms into a full-fledged criminal justice problem.
That's our hope, because we care about individuals. We want them to find success and have an enjoyable life. And that's the kind of balance we're trying to strike. Again, I have no real recourse for folks who commit a violent act, murder, rape. I'm not I'm not looking to that reform the situation, considering that done to other Floridians. But when you talk about the focus of what Right on Crime is all about, they're focusing on the individuals who've made that mistake, who were disappointed and angry with. But we don't want to be so angry with them that they have no life after this, or they turn to a life of crime, like you said.
So I want to move into the actual conditions inside our jails, our state penitentiaries. There is no shortage of controversy, even starting from your tenure in the legislature and kind of really moving through the last 8 years or so. We've seen a number of controversies with how things are handled. And not only that, but how much money goes into service programs, rehabilitation programs, and mental health programs in jail. And to that point, we have a question from Adam at the Beaches. Adam, you're on the air.
Oh, yes, I was had a question about on the mental health system within the jail cell. It seems to me that a lot of the people who commit these crimes have a mental health issue to begin with that compounds to get them there.
Right. Thank you, Adam. And what about that? We know that our mental health, our prisons are our biggest mental health service providers. We've heard that locally from a couple of politicians, and we've heard it statewide as well. What can we do more to treat people once they're already behind bars, so that when they get out, you know, maybe they don't end up back there again?
Now that's an excellent question and a good point. Thanks for calling in. I think that's what we're kind of focused on. Remember, we're spending so much money on so many prisoners. You mentioned $35,000 a year here in Florida to just keep them incarcerated in that jail without a lot of the programs in need and that are necessary to turn their life around if they have a drug problem or a mental health issue. And so by being more focused and putting that attention on not just simply locking them up, but into some of these other diversion programs, those costs a few thousand dollars a year versus tens of thousands of dollars a year. And that's what we're trying to do, is saying, are there some programs? You know, believe it or not, we've found some success. I read in national journals, and simply through people being in constant contact with that individual, showing they care. And that means not necessarily going to, quote, their shrink's office for mental health issues or their psychiatrist, but it means literally having a person spending time on the phone with them, letting them kind of air out their problems. And that's a simple phone call, or using the internet and using different face-to-face interactions, just like you would on FaceTime with your Apple iPhone or Samsung device. I mean, these are things that work when people feel like others care about them and they take the time, because maybe they come from a broken family or have a history of mental illness in their family. These type of programs can work, and we can stop this violent cycle, or this cycle of crime in general, or drug crime. And so we can, by freeing up the resources, we can put not all the savings into mental health programs or other counseling, but a portion of that savings, because, again, we've seen right now that a person get inside the criminal justice system, too often they lead eventually to a life of crime. We need to break that cycle if we can do so in a cost-effective manner and in a manner that's proven to be successful through another state. That's the balance we're trying to find here. And, with all the mental health issues and drug problems we do have still in our state, these counseling programs can make a real difference, not in every case. And we know we're never going to be perfect, but if we can help a large percentage of people, we make not only a better life for that individual, but that means fewer crimes against fellow Floridians as well.
Again, that number is 549-2937. We've got a couple of lines on hold right now, and we'll get to them in just a second. But we have a question from Brian, who tweeted the show, to lessen recidivism, should we have programs to assist ex-convicts, like the programs reintegrating veterans to civilian life? So essentially, not just the programs while people are in prison, or the diversion programs to keep them out of prison, but if they do go through prison, are there enough programs out there, and what kinds of programs would you like to see implemented to help reintegrate somebody who has paid their debt to society?
Now, that's a good question, and it goes to the point of that's what parole was designed to do, kind of given we've always heard of the term halfway houses, the concept of kind of making that adjustment back into life. You know, one of my favorite movies, it's a tough movie, but it's a heartwarming one in the end, is The Shawshank Redemption. We've all seen it, where a person is having a great difficulty, the older gentleman that's been there for a long time, making the adjustment back into civilian life, and literally wants to go back into prison because it's the only life they've ever known. These type of programs can work, as long as it's done in a thoughtful way. And what did not work in years past is just letting them out early and sending the message, hey, we're really not going to, quote, punish you for some of these offenses. But if you're in prison, what we want to do is say, how do we make that transition possible? How do we do it in a way where there's a support network? I mean, what a lot of people do when turning to drugs or violent crime is they feel alone or are having a hope. If there are other people who care about you, whether it be in a church setting or a community setting or family setting, your peer pressure is a positive peer pressure to, quote, do the right thing. It's when people feel despair and alone and there isn't a, quote, person to talk to, whether it be in person or some other way, that they turn to sometimes radical acts of violence and or other property damages. And that's what we're trying to look out to. We're trying to look at this in a very human way, meaning a very compassionate way. And it's just going to be, again, I'm not a pie-in-the-sky believer that, oh, it's all going to be roses and daisies. These are tough, and these are difficult tasks, and a lot of effort's going to have to be made for success. But it's worth it because this is why God put these individuals on earth, was to serve and be and love others, as opposed to just say, we're mad at this individual, let's just kick them into the jail, and if they come out bad, so be it, they deserve it. Mm-hmm. We're trying to strike that balance as good people, and I know it's a challenge, but I think we're up to it as a state, and I think it's going to save us money, and I think it's going to really turn some lives around, and probably in the long run, if we do this right and use some of these savings towards really helping people, that we're going to have a lower crime rate. I believe that. That's why I'm supporting this and why so many others are trying to find this right balance on property and drug small crimes versus violent offenders. I think we can do it as a state.
Sure. Well, and you know, we have another point here. The private prisons offer both Democrats and Republicans have engaged in this, but it offers a profit motive, some would argue, to incarcerating more people. And we've seen some of this, at least majority of this, kind of as far back as the mid-90s, where it was explicitly said by people like Newt Gingrich that yes, they wanted to fill beds in some of these prisons. And to that point, Bill at the Beaches has a question for us. Bill, you're on the air.
Yeah, you touched upon this. You're not going to do anything about the $250 billion unless you do the following, and that is make sure that industry gets out of legislatures. And that'd be globally. That'd be in all 50 states. As that percentage of private industry takes up the slack from what would normally be public prisons, you have a deep incentive to make sure that stays in force and effect. So nothing you're thinking about will be very effective in trying to convert that. And particularly, if you look at the types of laws that are being passed and the penalty for what they call malum prohibitum laws, these are laws that are put in force and effect, they're statutes, but there's no injured party. If you have no injured party, it's very difficult for me to think that, particularly if you go back and look at what the law looked like 30 years ago, they attach misdemeanor to it, they attach the second value of the misdemeanor, whatever it is, they keep ratcheting it up. And as they do that, that makes you more wedded to a system that becomes slightly more unfair as time goes on. If you don't remove the incentive from legislatures being influenced by lobbyists who have private industry in force and effect, any policy change or any ideas that you have about reformation get completely put by the wayside because, you know, they've got put their capital up already. You put your money up, you want a return, sure. And you have an expectation. And the only way to get a certainty about that is to make sure the law has that.
Sure.
I'll take your comments off there. Thanks.
Thank you, Bill. Now, obviously, you have experience both in the legislature creating policy and also lobbying for certain issues. But do you see, Mr. Senate President, as there being a kind of a perverse incentive here for certain private prisons or for certain legislators who, you know, maybe they are reform-minded and they want to get these reforms through, but we have to admit that there is a very, very strong private prison industry, and some would say that these types of reforms are at odds with their profit.
Yeah, I do understand the question well, and it's one that creates a lot of questions. I've never been lobbied in my career about, you know, let's put tougher penalties on from a lobbyist from the private industry. We are always lobbied in the idea of, look, we can provide a service to the state for less money, and we will reduce recidivism because we have these policies. But that said, look, this discussion, in my opinion, is not so much about dollars and cents and what we pay private versus public. Private prisons are actually a little bit less expensive in general. But what we're looking at is, as he put it correctly, you know, if there's a crime that did not directly injure another Floridian, let's be more thoughtful on how we handle that type of crime. And if it's a first-time offense or a drug offense, let's look at that policy. If we find, it, especially in my discussions with legislators over the next few years as we work on these policies, that some of these perverse incentives are trying to be pushed by whatever group might be, let's be aware of it and see how perverse that is. For that reason. So it's a challenge, but I think where the focus needs to be and wherever they're incarcerated, public or private, is are we doing the right thing so that when these people do get out of the prison system, are they ready to function in society or are they going to be an immediate threat to society? And so if we can put some additional dollars, because we're being smarter about how we spend it, into counseling programs and support groups, it's going to be a win-win because these people will be getting out.
Sure.
And more importantly, let's try to make it where they never get around some of these career criminals if they're a first-time offender so that they don't learn some of the bad ways of life or how to become, quote, a better criminal. These are challenges. And what I'm so impressed by with this Right on Crime group is they're willing to tackle these. They realize that we're doing better in Florida and taking on crime. But we can make a real impact in people's lives on both sides of the crime ledger, those victims as well as, of course, the perpetrators.
And I think everyone on any side of the political spectrum can probably agree the fact that the conversation is even happening is progress from where we were just a couple decades ago. We've got another question from Dixie in Riverside. Dixie, you're on the air.
Yes. I'm having to leave my home because of the crime wave we've been experiencing in the last 2 years. And I agree that perpetrators of violent crime need to be incarcerated. Whatever you do with them after that, that's one thing. But you can't just lay down on the property crime. It's constant. And the residents of Riverside are desperate for relief. There has to be some sort of negative consequences. If they could be made to do community service, there has to be some incentive for them to stop doing it. If there's a noise at night, I'd have to jump up and run and look out my window to see if they're breaking into my car. If you lock your car, they just break the window.
Sure. Well,
and yes, there's violent crime, too. If you look on the Nextdoor social media for Riverside and Avondale, it's just a constant thing, the property crime.
Thank you, Dixie. Thank you. We've got just a minute left here, and I want to kind of address that point of view. I mean, even though Jacksonville, our area, is much lower, kind of looking at a historical trend line, the crime is much lower. We've seen some spikes in some pretty scary crimes in the last couple of years, and residents do get scared. So what do we do with those who may be afraid and may not want to come around to a more reform-minded policy?
Well, first, I'm very sympathetic to Dixie, and she lives in a difficult area, and she's frustrated by it. But she kind of nailed it. You know, this can't just be, oh, too bad, we're sorry that happened. They've got, at a minimum, in that first crime they commit, and a property crime like that, they're going to have community service. They're going to have a penalty. They're going to feel the pain that if they do this again, that things are going to get worse. You can't just, quote, give a slap on the wrist. This has to be the counseling. This has to be intense community service. I still believe in the idea of positive peer pressure, meaning people being kind of put out there in public, that if you commit an act like this, you're going to be humiliated or embarrassed in that way, that you don't want to do it again. You're trying to, again, strike the balance. You can't just let these property crimes go by the wayside. What we're trying to say is you don't want to incarcerate a person for 4 or 5 years for a $500 crime. That's where we're trying to raise the minimums up to the $1,500 number approximately. But this is a balance that's tough, and my heart goes out to folks like Dixie. There's a lot of communities where I live that have some of these similar problems, and this is why we're having this discussion. You know, tomorrow is a big day for all of us, Thanksgiving, and a lot of us are so grateful for being an American and having a wonderful life, but a lot of people aren't blessed in the same way with a great family circumstance or financial circumstances, and we need to figure out ways so that they don't fall into crime, and hopefully we can have a blessing over the holiday that we can have this ongoing debate about how we can do this better, because I still believe that Floridians can continue this low crime rate without throwing away the key with some folks that who could be saved, and we're trying to strike that balance. And I just really appreciate the opportunity to share my thoughts and the group Right on Crime's thoughts and what we're trying to do to move this state forward. And people like Tixie deserve to have a voice, because they're feeling the fear of crime, and they need to make sure they let their impact now be known and strike that balance so that we can fix this problem, save money, and really turn some people's lives around in a positive way.
Sure. Well, I'm sure we could spend an entire hour or more talking about this, but we really appreciate you calling in and talking to us about criminal justice reform, the conservative case, Right on Crime, and this newest poll. Former Senate President Mike Haridopoulos, have a great, happy Thanksgiving.
To you as well, and our best to everyone. Happy Thanksgiving and blessings to you. Have a great day.
You too. We'll be right back.
Hendricks Avenue Baptist Church is a place to experience Christ's presence and God's Spirit in a vibrant faith community. HAB celebrates diversity, seeks to bridge differences, and journeys together in an honest and authentic search for truth. HABchurch.com. Find a different way of being Baptist.
Hi, I'm Melissa Ross.
And I'm Tom Hudson. Join us Friday for the Florida Roundup, a live call-in program where you talk about the biggest stories in the state.
This week, a special Black Friday show. As brick-and-mortar stores struggle to survive this holiday season, Florida cities are competing to land the next Amazon headquarters. Plus, a look at the state's budget priorities.
Join the conversation on the Florida Roundup.
Fridays at 1 on WJCT.
Welcome back. Well, the day after Thanksgiving, of course, is Black Friday, that bizarre tradition of waiting in lines for hours to purchase gifts at costs. Sometimes those gifts are more for ourselves than they are for other people, but I digress. Point is, there's going to be a lot of shopping between Black Friday, Small Business Saturday, and Cyber Monday, and you may have more to fear than being laid out by a ravenous bargain hunter group. According to the Federal Trade Commission, Florida had the highest per capita fraud rate in the U.S. last year. But hopefully, Florida Capital Bank's information security officer, Ed Bedis, can give us some tips to prevent your personal information from being stolen. Ed, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
So let's start with what are the most common risks here? I think of putting your card info online to purchase things like on Cyber Monday, but there are a number of physical risks as well, right?
That's true. And the thing is that a lot of folks now, they always, especially with the online shopping that's going on right now, they'll be checking emails and so forth. And there's a lot of people out there that will send fictitious emails out there to try to get information, credit card information, login information.
You've just won this prize. Please send us your credit card information to claim it.
Exactly. And other things that happen to card skimmers are also now available out there. And then a new thing out there that's like synthetic fraud is a new thing that's starting to come out.
Well, let's talk about those card skimmers, because normally people think of card skimmers as like the stuff that gets placed into a gas station pump, right?
Correct.
And it's stationary and it's there and somebody has to put it very sneakily and then take it off very sneakily. But there are many ways that someone just with a iPad or something like that can just swipe your card. How does that happen?
Exactly. And this works in many different places also, because you can also use it in restaurants or ATMs and as well as gas stations. But I'm going to use a gas station as an example, because it's actually happened to me. With the Department of Agriculture out of Texas, they've created and tested a method to go ahead and use your Bluetooth capabilities off of your cell phone. So if you have an Apple phone or iPhone or Android, you can use your Bluetooth technology that's on your phone to go ahead and scan the location. So what you would do is, if you drive up to a gas pump, what you would do is go ahead and on your phone go into the settings and start your Bluetooth and let it do a scan. And when it does a scan, if you notice that a device pops up that has a long string of numbers and letters, probably like about 10 to 15 digits long, there is a card skimmer that's on the pump. Now, it's not going to show what particular pump it's on, but you know that something is in the area.
Within the radius of that, right?
Bluetooth, correct. So what they do is what they're using that for is to download that information that swipes onto their device so they can misuse it somewhere else or create another credit card. So the thing is that typically if you do see that, I would personally take my credit card and go inside to the gas station attendant and let them prepay the gas at that pump.
And then what do you call the authorities? You call someone and say, hey, I think there might be a skimmer here.
Exactly. And the thing is the people you would do that is the naturally those red sticky labels that are on the gas pumps that do inspections, Department of Agriculture is who you would call.
Oh, so that's how they inspect the pumps. It's one part of inspecting, aside from the safety, is to ensure that there aren't any of these skimmers.
Correct. And other safety features that you can do too is also you can also buy a prepaid gas card if you wanted to. And then that way you can use it at the pump. If somebody does skim the prepaid card, they're not going to get too much, maybe $25.
Right. So. Hey, $25 is $25. Exactly. I would try to do everything in my power to get that back, that's for sure. So what can people do to avoid, because these are all great tips for avoiding some of the physical stealing of people's data, and also to be aware of what emails you're getting in, and to have maybe a good ad blocker or scanning emails when they come in. But what else can people do to track to make sure that it hasn't already happened to them?
Well, there's a bunch of low-tech ways that you can go ahead and catch some of these things that are coming. So there's ways of preventing some of it from even happening. Like on spoofed emails or phishing emails, typically the grammatical errors are the biggest things that you see on those emails. If you get an email and there's a bunch of grammatical errors that are on there, that's suspicious at that point, you know. And then a lot of them, sometimes the greetings are really unusual greetings. It says, hope this email finds you well. And it's like, okay, that's an unusual greeting for an email.
Right, and it's a red flag if someone is like, I am a relative of yours and I just want to let you know that someone died and they left you a bunch of money, then you can be like, okay, yeah, show me the money first. So before we wrap up here, we've got just a few seconds. How big of a problem is this really?
It's quite a large problem, and the synthetic fraud is getting even worse on that, making it even harder to detect. What's happening there is with some credit bureau information that's been stolen out there now, people now know some of the security questions that typically you would use to identify people, and they're creating identity theft issues with folks with legitimate accounts and so forth by using that information that was stolen. So they would go ahead and open up maybe like a new utility bill, and then from that, using the utility bill to open up an account for someone else at a different location.
There's enough information on that utility bill to do that.
Exactly. And what we're doing is we're trying to let folks know that, you know, the easiest way to take care of that is to check your credit report every year. By law, everyone's allowed one free credit report each year to go ahead and check your credit and find out if you have all of a sudden, you know, on my credit report, I've got a Macy's card, but there's no Macy's near me. So, that would be suspicious. So go ahead and check that. There's also companies like Florida Capital Bank is good for their customers. We use a company called Deluxe that does Provent for us, that does identity theft protection. So,
well, we could probably talk even longer about this, I'm sure. But Mr. Bitas, thanks for joining us, and have a happy and secure holiday weekend.
Thank you. Happy Thanksgiving to you.
We'll be right back.
The list of powerful men accused of sexual assault grows longer. A workplace should be safe for everyone, but far too often it is not. What will it take to change that and convince people with power and influence to make these changes permanent? Working in a World After Weinstein. Next time on 1A. Weekdays at 10 after First Coast Connect on 89.9 WJCT. Your community, your world.
For the next Jazz Night in America, we're in Philadelphia for a party of a tribute concert to the one and only Grover Washington Jr. With saxophonist Gerald Albright and Najee in the hot seat, backed by members of Grover's original band, it's music by and the legacy of Mr. Magic. I'm Christian McBride, and that's on the next Jazz Night in America.
Saturday nights at 8 on 89.9 WJCT.
I'm Christopher Kimball from Milk Street Radio. We're on the verge of a culinary revolution, and who better to ask about the future of food than Melissa Clark, New York Times columnist and author of 36 cookbooks, including her latest, Dinner. Are we giving up what used to give us pleasure just for the hope of something better? Melissa offers her thoughts on how you'll be cooking dinner in the very near future. Coming up this week on Milk Street Radio from PRX.
Sunday mornings at 7 on 89.9 WJCT.
WJCT and Vistar Credit Union are honoring the memory of Fred Rogers with the 15th annual Mr. Rogers Sweater Drive. The drive runs through November 30th and accepts new and gently used sweaters, jackets, and blankets. Contributions may be dropped off at WJCT and all Vistar Credit Union branches, Two Men in a Truck, and the Tom Bush family of dealerships. For more information, log on to WJCT.org. Contributions will be donated to selected nonprofit facilities within the First Coast area.
Welcome back, and finally this hour, French hornist Aaron Brask stopped by the studio earlier to tell me about his third annual holiday musical performance in San Marco Sunday. Brask is currently a hornist for the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra and has had the honor of playing with a number of local and nationally recognized musicians. Let's take a listen and get into the holiday spirit. Local French horn player Aaron Brask is here to tell us a little bit about the holiday programming this weekend. Aaron, thanks for being on First Coast Connect.
Well, it's pretty exciting for all of us who are involved in the project.
So tell me a little bit about yourself first. Let's start there. How long have you been playing the French horn, and do you play any other instruments? And are you originally from Jacksonville?
I grew up in Florida. I was born in Ithaca, New York, and I've been playing the French horn since I was 13. I went to music school. I got a job in the symphony orchestra. And while I was playing in the symphony orchestra, I met a lot of incredible musicians in this region who have either subbed with the symphony that I play in, or I just met them playing on other engagements. One of them was Bill Boston. Bill Boston was a composer orchestrator who lived in Los Angeles for about 17 years, and we had a mutual friend, and we became more and more interested in talking shop, and before I knew it, he and I were working on projects together. Years went by, and I said, Bill, how come you and I always work on other people's stuff, but we don't do our own stuff? Then we went, Vince Guaraldi, you know that music? Yeah. And then we made a recording of some of the pieces that were synonymous with the Charles Schulz popularity, and we feel that the music really added so much to those animated specials that we wanted to record not only that, but some of his other music. Then, of course, I'd been doing a lot of holiday programs, and we got this idea to go to a church and make a celebration with a mixed ensemble.
And so what is it about holiday music? And we'll get into the specifics around the San Marco event here in just a minute. But what is it about holiday music or Christmas music that that gets you interested in wanting to play it?
My mother was a choir director. She graduated with a master's in music, and nobody else was available in the church to direct the choir, so she did. She knew all the good hymns, and it's synonymous with my life. I grew up around that, and all the pieces that are written for this part of the liturgical calendar are pretty special because it celebrates the blessed event. And for those who have all those memories of families and everything, it's kind of the soundtrack to that part of your life.
Right. Well, and the soundtrack to this season, I mean, once you start hearing the holiday music being played, either at shopping centers and stores or in restaurants or with events like yours, it kind of just lets you know that we're here at this part of this festive part of the year. And I'm not entirely sure why some people kind of cringe at that. Some people maybe feel that Christmas music, pop Christmas music, is a little bit more cliched, but it really sets the tone for the rest of the year, doesn't it? And going into the next year.
Well, sure. The pieces that were written hundreds of years ago, they were the pop songs of their day. So it's no different than what's going on now. And we try to embrace that when we did the program, because certain things give you the moment to reflect and to step back. And some music makes you anticipate all the events that surround the family and friends of the holiday season. The music just makes that happen for you.
And then especially when you grow up with it, like you did, like I did, mm-hmm. and like a lot of people do in the United States, there's this special nostalgia that comes attached to it too, right? Because it's not just thinking about the Christmas season, but when I hear some of these songs, you know, I think about setting up the Christmas tree or my mother putting cinnamon in eggnog and giving it to us when we watch Christmas specials on TV, or my grandmother's cookies. Like, it's a very kind of warm and inviting feeling. But as we talked before we started recording, there are Christmas songs, some more popular than others. Think Carol of the Bells, like I mentioned, that are about not necessarily bleakness, but there's a certain dark quality about them. Can you explain to me why that is and how you feel about that specific kind of genre of holiday music?
Well, that's the totality of the human experience, the lows and the highs. The lows make you really appreciate the highs, and that's where the complete memories, bittersweet, nostalgic, wonderful, euphoric, they're all connected. And during this time, it's the end of the year, you tend to take stock of loved ones lost, loved ones yet to come. All those things happen towards the end of the year. And that's why when we wrote these pieces, it is celebrations. It's kind of hard to explain. You're celebrating the human experience. And during this time of year, people do have much more to reflect on.
Well, you can watch Aaron Brask and rest of his ensemble play all of the greatest holiday tunes at the South Jacksonville Presbyterian Church this Sunday in San Marco. Aaron, thanks for being on the show.
Yeah, one other thing I want to mention real quick.
Sure.
It's not a free concert where suddenly they close the door and pass the hat. This is really a free concert. This is for the entire community.
This is a real free concert, and no, they won't do the public radio thing where they just make you feel guilty about not donating. Anyway, Aaron, thanks for being on the show.
Thank you.
And that's our show. Thanks to all of our guests and callers. Our producer is Kevin Mershart. Michelle Corum runs the board. Never miss a show. Download the app. I'm Ryan Bank. You're listening to First Coast Connect. And Melissa will be back Monday. Happy Thanksgiving.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.